Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you who this is your first time, we welcome you also. Today, we have a really big show. And by that, I mean the first hour is going to have something like five, six of us on at the same time, plus any possible call-in. This is a kind of a first in terms of having that many guests at the same time. And we're going to be coming from a particular location, Tennessee. And you'll learn why we're coming from Tennessee in just a few minutes. Also, I have another guest co-host who is from Tennessee and who put this segment of our series together, and got to give her a tremendous, tremendous hand of applause here for the guest list that she was able to assemble and et cetera. So let me tell you who she is. Her name is Luciana Sanson. She currently is a teacher. She teaches English 4, British Literature, and an AP Literature class at Franklin County High School in Winchester, Tennessee. She is a member and moderator of the National Badass Teachers Association, an administrator for the Tennessee BATS, the Badass Teachers Association, and president of the Franklin County Education Association, the local teachers association in her home county. This past spring, she and 21 other teachers from Tennessee attended the White House Social and met with Ernie Duncan and Dr. Jill Biden to discuss educational issues. In July, she spoke at the BAT rally in East Washington, D.C., about how she built a network of grassroots activists across the state of Tennessee. She has been mentioned on or published in Diane Ravitz's blog, Jim Horn's blog, Anthony Cody's blog, Badass Teachers blog, the Cumberland Center for Justice and Peace newsletter, and the TNE Ed Report, and she was recently on the NPR radio show. Most recently, she has a piece published in the LA Progressive. She is an activist for public education, students, teachers, parents, and she excels in networking and speaking truth to power. And I want to add to that, she is a warrior personified for public education, teachers, students, parents, social justice. In the old days when we had encyclopedias, you would see her picture under warrior for public education. And with that, I want to say hello, Lucy, and welcome to the War Report.
Well, thank you. Hello, Dr. Miller. It's nice to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to co-host this show with you. And let me just say that was a stunning introduction, and I'm humbled by your work. So thank you.
Oh, wow. Somebody appreciates me.
Cool. Yes, very much so. Care. Very much so. And I'm very excited to be discussing these issues and focusing on Tennessee and starting the show today. So whenever you're ready, we can introduce our guests. from Tennessee, and we can have our discussion.
Well, why don't you, as co-host, as audience, my audience already knows, when I have a co-host, that person basically shares the platform. It's his or her platform just as much as it's mine. And in this case, I said, we have a fantastic array of guests. Lucy, take it over.
All right. Well, hello, everyone. This is Luciana Sanson, and I'm also known as TN Batgal. And I have put together a fabulous panel of guests, which I will introduce now. And we have Denise Wilburn from Tennessee, and she is co-author, along with Jim Horn, of The Mismeasure of Education, which is a book about ed reform in Tennessee specifically and how it has impacted our public schools. We also have Jim Horn, who is co-author with Denise Wilburn, and he is currently not in Tennessee at this point. Jim, I believe you are you teaching at Cambridge, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm in Cambridge, but today I'm in Vermont.
You're in Vermont, okay. I know that you travel and that you travel extensively speaking on public education, but I did want to make sure that I got that correctly, that you are a professor currently teaching in Cambridge. So thank you. We also have Nancy Bailey, who has a public education website, and she's an edu blogger for Tennessee. She's also works out of Memphis and Memphis schools, and she taught public schools for many years, and special education was her focus. And I'll let her talk a little bit more about her experience with special ed and the students, and specifically with our topic, which I'll be introducing shortly. And we also have Joan Grimm, Professor Grimm. Earlier I had mentioned that Joan was Dr. Grimm, and I actually made a mistake with that. She is Professor Grimm, and she is an education professor at UPK Knoxville in Tennessee, and she is amazing, and I've met her several times. And Joan also works with other education activist groups in Tennessee. And today we're going to be discussing value-added measurement in Tennessee, or VAM. VAM is sham. Hashtag VAM is sham, if you want to follow us on Twitter. And what I would really like to just say is value-added in Tennessee, basically they're synonymous in the fact that Tennessee is the birthplace of value-added. And what I would like to do is ask, Denise, if you don't mind, we can just start with you. And what exactly is value-added as far as your understanding? What is VAM, and how did it originate in Tennessee, and why?
Okay. The answer to that is a whole book called The Mismeasure of Education, but I'll give you the short
right.
form. VAM is value-added modeling, and it's a statistical model that looks at growth over time. And what it has been used for in Tennessee is to evaluate teachers based on how much their students grow over time versus what their student scores are on standardized tests at a specific point each year. In Tennessee, that's been used to evaluate teachers, evaluate school systems, and it has actually, as we say in the book, after over 20 years of using value-added modeling and almost 30 years of corporate-inspired reforms in Tennessee, we are further behind academically by locking wrong-headed assessments into state law and focusing on annual results of proficiency and gain. We have been distracted from our long-term responsibilities of providing meaningful learning environments for all of our students, but more specifically for our poor and minority students.
Right. Thank you. And I know that value added did originate out of the University of Tennessee. Joan, could you tell us a little bit about the professor at University of Tennessee that is the originator of the value-added measurement?
Well, I'll say that I was not a professor at UT when Dr. Sanders was there, but what I've read about Dr. Sanders is that he is a retired agriculture professor, and had understood the statistical configurations for I think evaluating the value of dairy cows, and so he applied that similar statistical model of value added to teacher test scores, and decided to essentially market it to the state of Tennessee as a way to effectively evaluate teachers and parcel out all the, what he says, you know, is error that might influence the score, and be able to really more accurately pinpoint the teacher effects on a child's test score.
Let me just get this clear. We're using a formula that was developed for dairy cattle.
It's called a mixed model. It's a mixed model statistical analysis, and you can use it for a lot of different things. He started out using mixed models for dairy cattle, but you can pretty much plug any numbers in it and come out with another number. And it could be, you can interpret it however you may want to interpret it. And there's a lot been written on all the test scores that have been inserted into this Tennessee TVOS. And it's not all as accurate as it claims to be. It was pretty effective, I think, for dairy cattle, but not so much for teachers.
Right, or our students with the testing.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Lucy, this is Denise again, and I would interject at this point in time that the way it has been used in Tennessee is for political and economic expediency. The Educational Improvement Act of 1992 was a period of time in Tennessee when they were facing a lawsuit for inequitable funding distribution across the state. They needed to raise taxes, business and industry, as well as the public at that point in time was not interested in raised taxes for education. And so in order to balance the political forces at that particular time, what McWhorter looked at, who was governor at that point in time, was, okay, we'll balance raising taxes for education and to earmark it for education with educational accountability. And that is when Sanders started really politicking with the legislature of Tennessee to say, hey, I've got the solution for you, and it is called value-added modeling.
Wow. So this was a Democratic governor, is that right, Denise?
That is correct.
And a Democratic state legislator.
Oh, okay. So where politically does this leave us? And this is a conversation for all of us on the War Report, so any of you guys at any point in time can jump in and discuss the politics. Jim, if you have something to add. Nancy, if you have something to add. Please, let's just have an open conversation, because we're all learning here, and I'm open to whatever you have to say.
Like to add something about Dr. Sanders. I feel like he's profited a lot by this, right? He made a lot of money, and I don't think that VAM, if you really look at the history of it, is really anything new. I know in special education he's maybe tweaked it a little bit, but when you look at special ed, we've been using the VAM model in some ways when we write up IEPs, individual educational plans for children. We always look at where a child's coming from. We consider testing. Teachers have always even done their own testing on children when they first come to them. And then the difference being, I guess, is that we've written goals for these children ourselves, and they've been more realistic goals than what you find today with, like, the Common Core standards. They've been goals that have been approved to parents. You could say that the IEP is one of the most one of the better accountability measures we've ever had. But I think they've used, there's always, and there's really this message that's out there now that educators don't have any research base. You know, I heard Bill Gates recently being interviewed by Lindsay Layton, and he kept saying there's no R&D. And I just think that's a real false message that has been allowed to just become sacrosanct all these years. And I think that's why people like Dr. Sanders from Livestock have been able to profit on education. And, you know, it's very sad that our own research hasn't been. Even in Tennessee, we've had the STAR study, which was wonderful, you know, that showed that K through third grade and lowering class sizes is really important, but no one talks about that study much anymore. So,
well, that's an interesting point. If I might jump in here, Nancy. I was reading about the Vergara lawsuit in California, and the tech industry millionaire that financed it, his name escapes me right now, but he was asked a question about, you know, the research on tenure, and he said he doesn't really think much of teachers' education research, even though he's never read it. But this is a person from Silicon Valley who really pretty much worships numbers, and if they see a complicated formula, they think it must be right. And therefore, since they just don't have a lot of respect for any kind of research that's outside of their own field.
And that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and when you look at the research out there about retention, which has been there for years, we've known that it's not good to hold students back, and yet, you know, the state of Florida has used that for years to keep third graders back. So, you know, they don't respect the research that's been done in education, and that's really very sad, and I think part of the whole reform movement.
It's really kind of disconcerting to know that the entire reform movement is based on, like, no educational research. It's based on research
exactly
that's coming out of business schools and business schools.
We have these venture capitalists that are basically disrupting and dismantling public education, much in the same way that we saw happen, I suppose, 20 years or so more ago, to healthcare and privatization of that and anything that can be privatized. I mean, public education has something close to, what, an $8 billion earmark, I think I read recently, and we're just ripe for the picking. So that's really what's happening here, and our voices, of course, are attempted to be drowned out by these corporate folks. Jim, we haven't heard anything from you today. Is there anything that you would like to add?
Well, I'm enjoying the conversation. A lot of good points have been made, I think. When I think about the current fascination with quantification, you know, this has been going on a long time in social sciences. At the beginning of the 20th century, when sociology and psychology were both new, Stephen Jay Gould wrote an important book called The Mismeasure of Man, where he used as the term for the social sciences that were being created during that time as being affected by what he called physics envy, that is, the search for quantification to legitimize social science has been going on for a long time. So what we see today in the current value-added assessment model is just a continuation of another form of quantification that's been with us for over 100 years.
Expensive form.
And it's what's really sad about that, to just bounce off of Jim's piece, is that we know so much more now about cognition and social skills development and how the brain develops. And we know that, especially really young kids, young children, that it takes a broader understanding of a broader
education beyond just academic skills to succeed in life. I mean, we know that cognition and test scores might be one piece of it, but non-cognitive skills are really more predictive of future success, and then that's actually been proven scientifically. And one of the things that these reformers just continually want to ignore, I think they choose to ignore it because they don't want to deal with it, is the effects on poverty. There's so much information out there now about how these early critical sensitive periods in early childhood lives affect future learning. As a matter of fact, young children are so tied to biology that if they miss, like, these certain critical ingredients in their environment, like early, I'm talking at birth all the way through age, you know, 5 or 6, that if they miss these ingredients in their environment, they may never recover, and it may lead to permanent impairments, like iron deficiency or lead or certain micronutrients that are missing in the diet. They all feed into a disadvantaged environment. And nobody wants to talk about that.
So I agree.
You're absolutely correct.
I agree so much with that. I think that for example, lead is a really serious issue. There have been a lot of studies about that, and you know, parents I think aren't even being made aware that when they move into a new home a few years ago, my husband and I looked at an older house, and we really fell in love with it. But when we looked into the lead removal, it was exorbitant. The house was pretty cheap, but to remove the lead in this house was really expensive. But when we drove by this house a few months later, someone had purchased it, and I saw that they had a swing set outside. And I just got the feeling they probably did nothing for the lead that was in that house. So, I mean, that goes across the board. It doesn't even have to be a poor child. I think that there really is a serious problem with lead, and yet people kind of push it, you know, sweep it under the rug. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think that was Denise or Joan.
Yeah, Joan. Yeah. And I think we're ignoring all the non-cognitive skills that are really critical for human beings to make a successful, you know, make successful lives for themselves. I'm really hoping that we can reach a time where human beings are making decisions about lives, not markets.
Right. That's funny that you mentioned that, too. I ran across a website. I was looking up information about VAM, and there's actually a website now in Florida that has capitalized on the recent the Times Union in Jacksonville put out the scores of the teachers several months ago. Mm. And they actually have a website now called myfloridateacher.com, and they're calling it market-based. And charter schools and parents can go to this site, and they're kind of encouraging charter schools to look up the best teachers, to choose those teachers, I guess, to somehow in some kind of competitive market. And that just sounds, you know, like such a business-like goal for all these folks. And so anti-public school, the public school movement.
So, well, and you can pick your teacher based on their TVOS scores or their FCAT or whatever?
In Florida, you can look up the teachers and their scores. You can also look up the disciplinary actions against the teachers. And with that part of the website, it doesn't tell you what they were disciplined for. There are a whole lot of teachers there, some that have even been fined. But you don't see what they did, and I don't know if they're still teaching. But it just seems like a very punitive website, but one that's used to facilitate this market-based competitive notion that they want schools to follow, where they all compete with one another, and you can compete by picking, you know, they have a special place where you can link up charter school owners to find the teachers that they will see are the best, the ones that have the best scores, and they can make
it.
Okay. Do you want me to try calling again on a different phone?
Yes, please call
back. Okay, I'll do that.
All right.
Well, this
Luke,
may be
can I interject
point.
Something here?
Yeah, go right ahead, please. Please.
First, Jim Horn, I'm
yes.
a sociologist, and you said something that I said 2 weeks ago on the same show about that phenomena of sociology and psychology envying the physical sciences, physics, chemistry, and et cetera, and deciding that they wanted to have the same respect as a science as physics, chemistry, and et cetera. You said the early 1900s. I wasn't around then, but when I started undergraduate, I want to get that point out. Because I know Lucia sometimes probably said this guy was back around, not beyond Dewey, maybe back in the 1800s or something like that.
You are not that old.
When I was an undergraduate, that was, the push was really, really, really strong then. And I took a methodology course in my junior year, and I raised the question whether or not it would make even any sense to try and emulate the physical sciences as a sociologist. I was a double major, psych and soc. That question got me in so much trouble that you wouldn't believe. That's one point.
Wow.
I didn't see, we had to do that. The second thing that you said that I want to comment on was that sociology, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we, two people come to mind, Daniel P. Monahan and James Coleman, and I mentioned this last week, what I'm about to say now, did major, massive, well-respected, well-designed, theoretically strong frameworks that were aimed at looking at education, what we call today sociology of education. And both of those studies laid the foundation for it's poverty, stupid, that affects education achievement.
Yeah.
We have known this for decades. And as several people have said already, you don't look at that because the amount of money that it would take to try and change the social structure of this society would be in the trillions of dollars. It is far easier and far cheaper to go with the business model and blame education, blame teachers, blame schools, than to try and deal with what we have known for decades, the underlying cause or causes of the gap between rich and poor, black, white, as relates to education achievement.
It's funny you should mention the Coleman Report, because my specialty is early childhood special education, and we did a lot of, we studied not only the Coleman Report, but the Moynihan Report, and a lot of James Heckman. Are you familiar with his work with early childhood education and Head Start? And there have been reams and reams and reams of research on the effects of early childhood education and early childhood special education. And most of the research shows that and what they didn't understand in the early days of the Coleman Report was that it was actually family life that plays a much larger effect on child school outcomes. And so over the past 40 years, there's been nothing but a corporate assault on family life. I mean, families have no time to spend with their children because they're working odd hours, they're getting paid minimum wage, so two people have to work. They don't even know week to week when their hours are going to be. You should see some of the families of the young children that my students work with don't know from week to week what their spouse's schedule is going to be. So their lives are just continuously chaotic. And we've created this situation now where we have young children, particularly children with disabilities, who are trying to survive
in these unpredictable lifestyles. And nobody really wants to look at the whole system. They don't think of education as part of a system. They just think of it as, you know, one single solitary factor that, you know, the masters of the universe can fix because they know how to fix everything.
But Sanders,
in their own mind.
I'm going to chime in one more. I'm going to chime in one more time on this. Back to what Jen said in terms of sociology and psychology. Sociology is a big picture discipline. We look at a family, we look at a community, we look at a city, we look at a state, we look at an entire country, we look at the entire globe in terms of how things are the way they are, how they function, how they got that way, changed, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That model is not, again, productive for the corporate reformers who want to take over public education for what you mentioned earlier, Lucy, the almost $800
billion. Billion.
When you add in higher education, the estimates are more like $1.2 to $1.5 trillion. Globally, it's $7 trillion. You can't, if you want that, you can't jump on parents too much because you need their kids in the school system so that you can get the money. So you don't blame the parent. You don't necessarily blame the kids because that's counterproductive. You don't blame the neighborhood or the community. That's counterproductive. And you certainly don't talk about racism, classism, sexism, because that's counterproductive to you getting what you need, and that is getting the kids in school, keeping them in school as long as you can, moving them from elementary, middle school to high school to university, because you can get money year after year after year, generation after generation. So, and everything that I've heard everyone mention so far, I keep saying to myself, it's the money. It's the money.
Oh, yeah.
And the money does not say to you, look at what is the reality there. Look at what we need to do to make the money. That's my
You're absolutely correct. And on top of what you just said, Governor Haslam has just initiated his Drive to 55, where we now have lots of money for students to apply and have their first 2 years of college paid for now through the local community colleges or four-year colleges that offer a two-year degree. So while he promised teachers in Tennessee raises and then went back on that promise, he has definitely made good on his promise of providing more money for these students that would not otherwise have the opportunity to pursue a higher education, especially students that have not done that. And, of course, it feeds into what you're saying about the fact that it's just a cash cow now. It's not about educating the child. It's about making the money.
And, Lucy, I have a question. I have a question about the money, and I'm wondering if that's the money that will it go to state universities, or will it go to the governor's school that he started up, or will it go to many of the for-profit colleges that we have? I mean, I'm thinking Capella, all of the diploma mill places.
Governor's University.
Or is it actually going to go to, state schools?
Right. I'm sorry. What was your question? Where is it going?
I wondered if you know if the money that the governor is proposing for these students when they graduate, can it be used to go to state schools, or is it going to be channeled to the, what is it, the Western Governors University, or
It's for two-year colleges, any college in Tennessee that has, like a four-year college that has a two-year degree program. So So it's say the community colleges, like Motlow State Community College, is participating in this. And the community colleges can choose to participate in this. And, of course, I know quite a bit about it because my high school is participating in this and my students are participating in this and they're applying and they're hopefully will be, of course, getting their college paid for 2 years if they do this program. And there are some stipulations that go along with this as well. I just find it interesting, not the fact that I am against my students having the opportunity to have the money to advance their education. I want to be very clear about that. But I find it very interesting that we can find money to pump into community colleges and money for schools that have bought into the Common Core agenda and all of these other things, yet you can't find money to fund teachers, but you can find money to fund technology, you can find money to fund testing, you can find money to fund anything and everything. But Tennessee, of course, is one of the teachers are some of the lowest paid in the nation, especially your public school teachers. And, of course, I know this firsthand. My husband and I are both public school teachers in Tennessee. And so I just find all of this really interesting to sit back and watch Haslam say one thing and then turn around and find money left over from our lottery, which is what he's saying that this is from. We've got leftover money, so we've got to make sure and use it to further the education of our students.
And I guess
Luciana, to expand on low,
helping the businesses in Tennessee. If you know, the 2-year programs to me are, you know, indicate that they might be channeling students towards 2-year programs that will lead towards employment in some of the businesses here.
Oh, definitely.
Would that be? Yeah.
Yes, it's very, 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 very true. And the Chamber of Commerce. In all of the different locations. I know in Nashville, the Chamber of Commerce is partnering. You know, they're very pro-Common Core and trying to make sure that we get our students lined up on these paths so that they can go to the different schools and the businesses then can cherry-pick the students based on their proficiency levels or based on how they want to sort of what pathway they've chosen, how they want to apply that. So it's all based on the college and career ready. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there's a little trick in that financing as well. Governor Haslam's associate, I think it was on the radio, on NPR, talking about this initiative that he was announcing of free college. But the students don't get money for college until after they've completed their FAFSA form, and that's the school loan form. So whatever the school loan won't cover, then the state of Tennessee will take some of that lottery money and pay the difference. So they're not really getting school for free. They're still taking out college loans. Now, I find that to be a bait and switch. If you're sending somebody to college, you're paying for their college. You're not paying first for them to take out a college loan and then covering the difference.
See, I haven't heard about the loan
there's
part.
There's got to be a... Oh, that, and the reporter asked him a couple of times, is college really free if they have to take a loan out first? And he brushed by it. And, you need to look at the details of this to find out if students are really being encouraged to, if all of their tuition is being covered by taxes or if they're also going into debt because there's a lot of money being made on college loans.
Right, yes, I'll definitely look into that.
This has been a pattern of governors since Lamar Alexander in looking at diverting a percentage of the total state budget for education into interest that they would benefit from. And so if you look at the history of the education budget in Tennessee from 1977 to currently, as a part of the total education budget, it has decreased from 42% of the budget when Lamar became governor to, I believe, last year's percentage of the total budget, education was 17%. So each governor has diverted money from education to other interests, whether that be foreign investment, whether that be private prisons, health care or looking at investment in student loans for a two-year degree, specifically in areas that would support corporate corporations in hiring their next generation of workers.
And the thing that makes this even more egregious than the fact that the budget is, the percentage of the education budget has been more than halved over that time span, is that the rhetoric, the cynical rhetoric, continues that education is going to be the solution to bringing kids out of poverty and into the middle class, when we know, as was mentioned earlier, that the longer we continue to ignore the structural issues around poverty and inequality, the more expensive it's going to be to fix them. There's a statement, Jean Anion, who's a professor in I think she's at City in New York, said that thinking that we can improve schools without improving the communities around them is like trying to clean the air on one side of a screen door. By continuing this cynical facade that schools are going to do are going to be the magical cure to end the achievement gap or the poverty gap is simply ludicrous and foolish talk.
And it's really slick talk. I attended several weeks ago, just out of interest, the Memphis Institute, the Memphis Leadership Institute, which was made up primarily of people from Stanford Children, the woman who's running Teach for America, and they also had the Grizzlies basketball team rep who supports charters and several charter people. And they were really slick, you know. They had such an orchestrated message. And the message at one point, they started talking about how money doesn't matter, how the research has come out that money doesn't matter. That's a common refrain they say about public schooling, that money doesn't matter. Well, it doesn't matter unless it's a for-profit school, then it matters. But, you know, that was brought up when I asked about what it would take to, I asked a couple questions. One was what it would take to start a charter school, and they said, you know, no qualifications, but you have to have a good plan. But these people are very, very pointed about their agenda, and, you know, it sells itself to poor parents. Poor parents really buy into their message. They really think that if their kids get high test scores that they will go on to college, and all you need is a cornerstone prep that has college pendants on the wall that tell them that their child's going to go to Harvard or whatever. So a lot of poor people really buy into these messages that are so carefully orchestrated by some of these groups that support reform.
And by the way,
I think that's why it's critically important. I'm sorry.
Exactly. No, exactly. And if you actually look at the data that the Tennessee Department of Education has on their website about charter schools and public schools, the testing data, students that are scoring proficient and advanced are the ones in the public schools, not the ones in the corporate charter schools. And the Achievement School District in Memphis, and which now is coming to Nashville, unfortunately, has their mission statement says nothing about education. It says everything about how we're going to take over the lowest performing 5% or schools in the lowest, you know, the lowest performing 5% of schools, public schools, and we're going to take them over and remake them and put them in the top 25%. And Tennessee is the fastest growing state in the nation with our test scores. Obviously, we're the fastest growing state in the nation for padding the pockets of the corporate ed reformers.
Right,
I mean, that's
right.
That's the truth, you know, not benefiting our students at all. And they're very, very obvious about this if you know where to look. But people just don't know where to look. And that's what
it's a marketing campaign. It's not based on any kind of educational campaigns.
Right, exactly.
And if they create the illusion of success, and Kevin Huffman is essentially
started it in Memphis, and I think he has plans for this for the whole state of Tennessee, is to have
the entire regional
for-profit multi-school areas just run by, like, education management organizations.
Yes, it is, and the entire state. That's scary,
right,
to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
Okay, yeah. if it's scary, let's move into the latter half of what the show is about today, and that is there a rising resistance to what's going on there in Tennessee? Going back to VAM being the engine that is used to drive all of the corporate reform programs, starts with schools are failing, kids are failing, teachers are failing, public
schools
failing.
Right, and
here's the data. So now, you have
this going
on.
So opting out and refusing the test is one of the things that is an option, of course, that parents are not aware of. We don't have a legitimate legal opt-out option in Tennessee. And the rest of you guys can jump in as well. We have to refuse the test. Unfortunately, legally, our student test scores and our teacher evaluations are tied to a certain percentage of these test scores. So we really have to form a rebellion in Tennessee. And I think that is brewing with parents. However, it has not come to a full boil yet, but I think that this year, hopefully, we will see parents and teachers start to emulate others across the United States with refusing to give the test, like Peggy Robertson has done and a kindergarten teacher has done in Florida. We do have parents across the state that are already refusing the test and writing amazing letters. We've got Mama Bears out of Memphis. We've got Nancy, who's on now, and her education website, which, Nancy, if you'll talk a little bit about this, you could probably shed some light on the parental rebellion.
Well, there is a parental rebellion. I think if you, not just in Tennessee, I mean, Florida's really stood out with that. But before I say anything more about that, I think, too, in Tennessee last spring, it was a tremendous success that the NEA pushed back on the TVOS. I mean, I think that they, really cared about their licenses. And so they really did a campaign, right, to approach the legislators who, I think, have always been heavily influenced by special interests. We've got, real special interest groups here and very wealthy people who have tremendous power in education who really seem to be able to push the issues and bring in, Gates and Broad and everybody else. So that the teachers were able to stand up against that when it came to their licenses and the TVAS, I think that was really tremendous. And I have to say, we should thank the legislators for that. I think if you look at other states, I taught a lot in Florida, so I tend to always go back to Florida, but I just don't think the legislators there are listening at all to the teachers. They might be listening to the parents, though, because parents are just fed up with the testing. They don't want it anymore, and they don't trust it. They don't trust what's going on. I think they have a real problem, and it's caught up with all the Common Core stuff, A lot of conservatives don't like the Common Core. I think, in a sad sort of way, it's funny, because I think people who are conservative that are interested in politics have a real problem with their party. The Republicans do not like the Common Core, and Democrats don't like it either. They like to constantly say, well, it's the Glenn Beck crowd. But there are a lot of liberals that do not like Common Core as well. So I think there is tremendous pushback on both the parts of parents, and it's starting to give when teachers see that parents are going to back them, then they start standing up. And there have been some teachers standing up now to power as well. And, they're trying to make sure. I feel sorry for teachers because, we're in an economic downcline here, so we don't want decline. So we don't want teachers to lose their jobs. They have families to support. It's hard for them to stand up for what they believe in. But when they have the backing of parents, I think it makes them courageous, and it makes them really want to fight for what's happening in their classroom. So I have some hope. I really do. I think some things are starting to turn around.
That's excellent.
Yeah, I think Nancy has a good point. It was last year or the year before what Kevin Huffman wanted to do was to use the value-added test scores and tie those scores to a teacher's licensure.
Oh, yeah.
And
when
trying
he did
to get that approved by the State Board of Education. And the TEA attorney put together a fantastic presentation. And in several of those slides, he showed how Kevin Huffman had actually misrepresented the data. I mean,
yeah,
purposefully.
Imagine that.
So we've got people actually lying about the data. And so,
and the data is
because of
a sham, obviously.
Right. And so because he was able to point that out, the one of the state legislators made it illegal to tie TVOS scores to a teacher's licensure. Now, still, the teachers in the state of Tennessee have their entire careers tied to this, to TVOS. And I firmly believe that until individual state legislators start fearing for their seat by being primary challenged, things are not going to change, okay? They're changing slowly. There's a lot of parents pushing back, and I really firmly believe that parents are really going to be the saviors of teachers because they were the ones that got lots of legislation passed in special education. But there are too many legislators in East Tennessee who are on the Education Committee who are just skating through every election without having to worry about their seat. And they voted for a lot of this toxic legislation. So what I'm hoping to see is in the next few years, people starting to push back and say, well, if you're going to keep voting this way, then we're not going to vote for you.
Right.
And that's not necessarily taken root in East Tennessee. Now, it may be the case in Middle and West.
That was going to be my question.
I was just
going to
say that Kevin Huffman has lost an awful lot of credibility, too. There's been, I don't know how many petitions up against that guy, even done by superintendents. So I whenever anybody even talks about him, there are red flags that go up all over. I don't know if people really trust him, you know, and not just teachers and all of us, but, I mean, the general public, I think, has some real concerns about his leadership.
We're beginning to approach our cutoff time, but what I wanted to get some response to is we've identified the problem. It seems that Tennessee is behind many other areas across the country that are resisting, pushing back in significant ways. The idea of it's going to have to be legislatures rather than the public or, like in some areas, litigation to bring about hopefully the type of change that we all would want to see come about. If that's the case, where are the teachers and teachers' union in trying to make the state's population aware of the individual legislatures and their stance on the issue so that you can inspire competition, using their words from the market people, competition at the primary level to put pressure on people to either run for office, to get rid of people who are being very detrimental to public education, or to force those same people to take a more moderate or progressive stance.
Well, let me just say,
unions doing.
They are doing that actually, and they had a mail-out campaign. And since I'm the president of my local, I am a member of TEA and NEA as well. But there's a huge campaign to vote for the legislatures that have backed TEA the past legislative session on the Hill, and that's Democrats, Republicans, you know, across the board. Those who are in support of teachers in public education and TEA have been endorsed or advertised or advocated for. I know my local representative has been advocated for on TEA, and of course we know that we've got many, many, many supporters that are running again for state legislator, and hopefully we can get those people in. We're also trying to promote teachers to run for offices as well, and that's something that I think that you'll see is teachers and parents standing up and taking on these leadership roles and getting these people that have the corporate interests out. But TEA is definitely being a great advocate for the legislators and on the Hill. So our union is definitely backing the teachers and trying to keep us safe as far as the legislation and things like that go.
TEA.
If I might say something, Bruce. Yeah, sorry. If I might say something quickly, I think that there needs to be a legislative push for sure. I don't think that's where this problem is going to be solved, though. I think it's going to be solved in the courts.
Yeah.
And it's going to be solved by a popular uprising against this nonsense.
Yes.
You know, the legislative solution is a good one, but we don't have the resources or the time to get that done before public schools are demolished. I think it's going to take something more radical, more active.
Our students are going to have to speak up, too.
Something that's going to have to be taken into the courts.
Right.
And
it is
in the courts in Tennessee.
I agree with
Jim. Let me say this.
It
is in the courts in Tennessee. TEA has filed two lawsuits in which value-added modeling has created a situation for two teachers in which they didn't receive compensation in their jobs because of value-added modeling. So I think those lawsuits will be very successful, and I think they will lead to more lawsuits. In the state of Tennessee, there are going to be more lawsuits than anyone can count because the lack of validity, reliability, and fairness in value-added modeling.
Can you send me links about those two lawsuits? I'm tracking lawsuits across the country as it relates to our issue.
I certainly can. Is your email on your website?
Yes, or you can get it from Lucy.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I can send it to you as well.
Okay.
Guys, thank you so
Let's get final comments because we are now running out of time. Let's get final comments, and then we'll have to say goodbye.
Thank you, everyone, for coming onto the show today with me and speaking about VAM as a sham, value added. I appreciate it so much. Is there anything that any of you would like to say as a final comment?
Well, I'd like to thank you, Lucy, for inviting all of us. And I'd like to make one point about the lawsuits. And I think for parents of kids who have disabilities, it's really tough because the laws are sort of written against them now. And when they go to try to get in touch with a lawyer, a lot of the lawyers don't really understand education law. They get, you know, I had a parent tell me recently that, you know, and the expense, the lawyer didn't quite understand the law, and also they didn't have the money. It was just so expensive. So parents just really need to organize, I think, across the country somehow to somehow deal with that and to try to find some pro bono lawyers that are out there that would be willing to try to understand the complicated language and all and to help those parents. So, but thank you so much for inviting me on the program.
Anyone else?
Thank you, Lucy, and thank you, everyone. I enjoyed the time, and I hope we get to do this again.
Definitely. We've had so much.
That's a distinct possibility.
I
would say thank you very much, and I'll be happy to come back anytime and talk more.
Thank you, Jim. Who have we not heard from?
Let me say something. That is very much a distinct possibility that we can get together again, either in this format or a couple one-on-ones or what have you.
And Jim, I would love to be able to get a review copy of your book so that I can have you and your co-writer on a show to do a one-on-one discussion about the book and et cetera. Is that a hint? Yes, it is. Is it a heavy-handed hint? Very much so. But if
we'd be
that
glad
could be
to.
Arranged, I would love to have that as soon as you can get it, as soon as we can get back together in that type of format. Okay, I'm going to go into a second hour with Fair Test with Bob Schieffer, and we're going to talk more about this. Our topic today was the rise and fall of VAM in public education. Today's was part three of what now a four-part series. And so if you can, you can tune in to us on your computer or your smartphone and listen to what's going to take place there. You can also call in and add more comments to what the discussion is all about. I thank you, and Lucy, of course, you know I thank you profusely. You put together a fantastic panel, and I mean it sincerely that, yes, we can get back together. That's the one thing about me being the producer as well as the host of the show. I can say we can be back together. So with that,
thank you, James.
I'm going to have to say goodbye to everyone so that we can go to our next segment, and I'm going to do that in about 2 to 3 minutes. So
All right. Thank
you, everyone. And
thank you.
Tune in again.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome. And I ask everyone to listen to the show when it's on. Not just when you're on it, but listen to the show. And call in.
Will do.
And
will do. I do. I've been listening to all of them.
Right.
I got two people that listen. Lucy listens and now someone else, okay? My audience is growing by 50%, 100%.
Your audience is growing, definitely growing. Thank you so much for having us all on the show today.
And keep up the good work.
Network, take us out, please. For those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. As if hopefully those who are listening now listen to the first hour of the show, and you will know that this is part four of a series that I call The Rise and Fall of VAM, Value-Added Measures in Public Education. We have spent the last three shows, part one, two, and three, trying to define for everyone what VAM is, high-stakes testing in education, its origins, what has made it popular, its application consequences for those in which VAM has been applied, and we've talked about resistance to VAM as part of the resistance to the corporate war on public education. Part four today, we're going to be fortunate to have one of the foremost persons who are working in the area of resistance and have been for a long, long time. That's Mr. Robert A. Schieffer. Bob has served as Public Education Director for Fair Test, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, since its founding in 1985. He is also a member of the organization's Board of Directors. Prior to the creation of Fair Test, Mr. Schieffer was educational writer at NBC television affiliate in Boston and research director of the Massachusetts Legislature's Joint Committee on Human Services and Elderly Affairs. He also worked for several years as a research associate at the Education Research Center of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, better known as MIT, where he was both an undergraduate and a graduate student. He is the author of numerous publications, to wit, I refer to Standardized Tests and Teachers' Competence. I also Stand Up to SAT, and he contributed to SAT Wars, the Case for Test Optional College Admission. He has done many, many things, and he is listed in Who's Who in America, who's who in the world, who in the East, as well as Strathmore's who's who in the National Directory of Who's Who in Executive and Professional. Bob, I'm running out of breath trying to tell people about you. So why not let you come
in and
finish it off, and then we'll get to business at hand. Did I leave out anything?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. As you heard, this show is about trying to make the public aware of what I call the corporate state war to destroy public education and the rising public resistance to said war. That was sort of my vision, my mission from day one, and all the shows have been geared towards that. Going back to 1985, what was the things that were happening that inspired both the need for and the creation of fair tests back then?
At that time, we were seeing the first wave of state graduation competency tests, in which state legislatures were passing laws requiring students to take an exam and score a particular level on that in order to be awarded a high school diploma. The data from that showed that not only were the exams very poor measures of educational preparedness, but the tests had a very significant racially disparate impact, in which African Americans, Latinos, and New Asian immigrants fell at a much higher rate than Anglo students. And fair tests grew out of a national conference which had leaders of national civil rights, education reform, feminist, and student activist groups talking about the problems of standardized testing, and they agreed unanimously that there needed to be a single national organization that served as the nation's standardized testing watchdog and advocated for better forms of assessment, and that created the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, or FAIR Test for short.
Wow. I didn't know that history, per se. Because one of the things that I would say if I was on the other side was that in Europe, from whence hence our overall special university system grew out of, they give this end of year, end of preparation, I'll call it, routinely, and have been for decades. In the 70s, when I was going to Europe almost every year, one of the things I would always do was go to nearby college or universities and high schools and talk to people. And one of the first things that I was told was that at the end of the year, they have these big, huge cumulative exams that if you don't pass, you don't pass. And also your future in terms of being able to get into college or university rode very heavily on that. So what was bad about the United States?
Every nation has a different assessment system. The European ones, which are generally graduation tests at the high school to college transition, like the French baccalaureate or the German arbiter or the British A level, they are very different from the kind of exams given in the U.S. They tend to be essay exams in Europe based on cumulative knowledge, where U.S. tests tend to be low-level factual regurgitation delivered in a multiple-choice format, which measure very little and don't do it very well.
I'm glad you put it that way, because that's what I was looking for. That having had some experience in different cultures as relates to education, et cetera, I noticed the same thing that you just mentioned. But I want to tell you also, I didn't see it myself here in the 80s like you did and others. My I was thinking as you were talking that the only thing that I can compare that to is when I took my comprehensive exam for the PhD.
Mm-hmm.
That was the kind of test that they seem to give in Europe versus, of course, the kind of test that we give here now and back then with our public schools. And the consequences are pretty much the same. You pass or you don't pass, and if you don't pass, mm-hmm. you're in a world of hurt, et cetera. So that perspective, I think, is really good for our audience, because one of the things that I also have said from the very beginning of this show is the importance of creating awareness about what is going on. So much of what's going on, the public is totally unaware of. And without awareness, there will be no, though I think there will be a very difficult chance of understanding what's going on if you're not totally aware of it. And certainly the next step in that model that I talk about is being able to become engaged emotionally and seeking to work for the type of change that we hopefully all believe is necessary. So Fair Test saw this back in 85. And what did you guys do back then to start this all
well,
off?
Well, you know, two things. One, we developed a very specific critique of what was wrong with current tests. And we also advocated for better forms of assessment. For example, in the university admissions world, we became the primary advocate of what's called test optional admissions, replacing the SAT and ACT with a system in which schools look, an admissions office looks holistically at an applicant's portfolio, not at their test scores, looks at their grades and their class rank and the work they've actually done and their extracurricular activities, community service, family background, et cetera, and makes a general judgment as to whether that student is a good fit, rather than looking at the numbers and saying you're in or you're out. And we've had great success in that area. There are now about 850 accredited bachelor degree colleges in the United States that don't require SAT or ACT scores from all or many applicants. At the K-12 level, we've advocated what's called alternative assessment or performance assessment, which is very much more similar to what you described for your comprehensive graduate school comprehensive. When you're asked some in-depth questions by professionals in the field, both in writing and orally, and you have to defend your work. We work, for example, with a group of schools in New York State called the New York Performance Standards Consortium that does that just that. They've gotten rid of almost all multiple choice tests, and they treat high schoolers like thinking individuals, young adults, and have them demonstrate what they know and can do in order to earn graduation.
Yes. Like a portfolio sort of model.
Well, portfolios, performances, exhibitions, and defenses, they all go together. But yes, it is a look at the collected work that a student does over time in a variety of ways, rather than looking at how well they fill in bubbles at test time to make high-stakes judgments about whether they should move on in education.
And you guys started this back in 1985.
That's right.
That's amazing. I would bet you most people, well, I would say, and I'm not saying this disparagingly, but most people are not aware of Fair Test, and they're certainly not aware of what Fair Test has been around as long as it has. And I'm going to argue, or I won't say argue, I'll put out the proposition. They don't have a clue as terms of a range of issues that Fair Test has taken on in the past and today. For example, and this is one of the questions I was going to ask you, and I'm asking it out of my sequence here, is that I would bet there are so many people unaware of the fact that you're heavily involved, as you just mentioned, at the college level. If they are aware of you, I would think most people are aware of you at the K through 12. Am I anywhere close to being right on that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to judge. I mean, most people are not aware of most things in the society. If you look at our website, which attracts about a million unique users a year, the majority of them actually look at our university admissions-related materials. We maintain there a free list of all the schools that are test optional, and that, you know, that pulls down a couple thousand visitors a day during college application season, about a third of a million unique visitors a year. But our K-12 materials also gets a lot of attention, and we're regularly covered in major media outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, Los Angeles Times, as well as in social media. You know, Diane Ravitch's website posts our stuff several times a month, the answer sheet at the Washington Post, and Facebook and Twitter. We're all there. It's, you know, it's a big country, and there are hundreds of millions of people out there, most of whom aren't concerned with education or testing at all. But I do think that the people who focus on educational assessment know of FairTest and know what we've done.
And appreciate you immensely, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know if they do or don't. You know, there are some people who disagree strongly with FairTest. They tend to work for either the companies that manufacture tests or the corporations or foundations that fund test and punish policies, or politicians who are enthralled to that ideological perspective. But we have a large and growing constituency, and work now in the last couple of years with a growing, rapidly growing resistance movement in the K-12 arena that is fighting back against testing overkill at the local, state, and federal level.
Well, that's also one of the areas that I want to take us into. Going back to from 1985 to where we are today, you saw certain things back then that led to the need and then the creation. But also, what have you seen over the intervening years that has led to, one, the need again and the continuation of a presence of something like FairTest?
Well, we've seen the pendulum swing back and forth a couple times about assessment. In the late 80s and early 90s, there was great progress and innovation at the community and school and district level, developing better forms of assessment and moving forward with them. And then in the mid-90s, politicians of both parties got the notion that the way to improve schools was to create ever more tests, raise the bar, and punish students, teachers, and districts for their school performance. There were several attempts in the 90s to impose national tests, first by the first president, George Bush, and then by Bill Clinton, both of which failed due to coalitions in which FairTest was involved, sometimes with very unusual allies, like the far right against federal government testing. But unfortunately, in the spirit of national unity following the 9/11 attacks, Republicans and Democrats agreed to a scheme that the then President George W. Bush proposed called No Child Left Behind. It was based on what he had done in Texas, so-called Texas Miracle, which turned out to be totally fraudulent, based on faking numbers to make the false claim that schools in Texas were getting better. But you know, in the spirit of working together, Congress foolishly approved in late 2001 the No Child Left Behind law that instantly tripled the amount of federal mandated testing in this country and created very high stakes for district schools and required them ultimately, less over time, to have every child magically transformed into a proficient testament taker simply because the federal government said so by fiat. And then many states followed up on that with adding tests of their own. And then the last several years under Barack Obama, it's gotten even worse. So he ran for president criticizing the unnecessarily high and dangerous level of testing, He hired as his education secretary not the people who were advising him during the campaign, who were good reformers, but a guy named Arne Duncan, who had been the head of the Chicago schools, where he imposed lots of tests and didn't make any academic progress. And under Duncan, the Obama administration has doubled down on the failures of No Child Left Behind through so-called Race to the Top program and waivers to No Child Left Behind, which have required states to do ever more testing. Now, from an organizing perspective, as awful as that was, that has created the climate in which people are fed up. They're saying enough is enough to testing overkill and pushing back in local and state campaigns to force politicians to back off on testing overkill and move to better forms of assessment. And interestingly enough, that movement began, the rejection of testing began where the testing movement began, in the state of Texas, with first school boards and superintendents, and then the legislature saying, we've gone overboard, we got to roll back standardized tests. And in the last 2 years, that prairie fire has caught on across the country.
Wow, that was a mouthful, and you stated it so elegantly, what we have been talking about on this show for the last, I don't know how many episodes, you hit it all. I'll add one thing to this. Let's take it back before the Bushes, back to Reagan, and you know where I'm going with this, with A Nation at Risk.
Right. A Nation at Risk report in 1984 claimed the U.S. was way behind everybody else and that it was equivalent to a foreign invasion, that we had to do something. It didn't specifically advocate testing, but it helped create the climate. I mean, the two key events on the other side were the publication of Nation at Risk and the education summit that Bill Clinton chaired when he was governor of Arkansas that began pushing for high-stakes testing.
Alone, Alex, was it the governor at the time, and was it Tennessee?
I'm sorry?
Alexander? Was it Lamar Alexander?
Was governor of Tennessee and then Secretary of Education.
Yeah. I mean, he's along with Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
There was another person, too, who's accredited with the big three that decided to launch their version of public education in America is failing and we need to do something about it. And
well, Louis Gerstner, who was the president of IBM, was another key player.
That's the guy who I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always been a significant corporate and foundation angle to the push for high-stakes testing, often by people who don't do a particularly good job of running their own businesses, but they know everything about education because they're the smartest guys in the room. Just ask them.
Well, basically what we're talking about now is the rise of high-stakes testing. That's what this whole series is about. So adding to that is I'll go back to one of the earlier shows when I made the statement that the business interest has been present from the very beginning of public education. They have been trying to define the purpose, create the vision, the mission, the strategy from the very beginning, and been not successful throughout the decades until we got into the 1900s, where we had the standards movement along with the choice movement and their initial failures. Then regrouping, coming back, and adding the rhetoric from the civil rights movement to make this a political as well as an economic thrust of theirs, so that we have had these, I'll call them right for now, these same people pushing for 150 years or more to redefine or to define public education
in their vision. And the three things that we talked about earlier in terms of Sputnik affair that led to the nation at risk, Clinton and Alexander getting together, Bush, Texas miracle, and Obama's disastrous race to the top, is an evolution of business interests finally being able to take charge, basically, of public education. And we hence the vehicle, which I argue and most of us, I think, do, has been tests, using tests to achieve their end goal of destroying public education and erecting in its place privatized education. Mm-hmm. So testing has been, I want to go out and say on this limb by myself and saying that it was, for the longest of time, the weapon of mass destruction aimed at public education.
And it certainly is a major tool that is used to make the claim that public education is failing and as a lever to bring in the kinds of policies that corporate and ideological groups such as school choice, so-called merit pay for teachers, et cetera.
Yeah, and so we're at a... Where are we now? You know, you've been looking at...
I think we're at a very exciting point. For the first time in Fairtest history, there is a truly a mass movement fighting back against standardized testing and making successes. There's a new report out just this month on our website called Testing Reform Victories, the First Wave, that in our website's fairtest.org, F-A-I-R-T-E-S-T.org, and it summarizes the whole list of wins that our movement has achieved, from getting four states to repeal graduation tests in the past couple of years, to get states like Texas and Virginia to roll back the number of tests they required, and great tactics like opt-out campaigns and teachers refusing to give the test and students walking out and school boards passing resolutions saying, we're not going to do this anymore. All of those reflect a growing national sense that we've gone way too far into the realm of standardized testing, misuse, and overuse, and that we need to reverse policy. So there's now political force, there's clout behind the push for assessment reform. And one of the interesting things about that movement is that it is not confined to one place on the political spectrum. Sure, there are progressive educators like the Badass Teachers and groups like Fairtest and the teacher unions, but there are also lots of folks who identify as just plain moms who are not political, and there are plenty of right-wingers who are fed up with the federal government and state government dictating from inside their ivory castles how local schools should run. And together, those groups create a sufficiently large critical mass that they've been able to force some change by politicians. We need to make much more progress, and we will in the coming year.
So you're optimistic.
I'm very optimistic in the short run. I don't think anybody would have predicted how much progress we could have made. And when we see in places like Texas, and in Georgia, where elections are being run with a primary issue being, is testing out of sync, where we have school districts in Southwest Florida and Colorado Springs saying we're going to opt out of standardized testing. It is a national movement of people who are fed up and they're not going to take it anymore.
And don't forget Lee County.
That's Lee County in Southwest Florida,
too long.
Where I live.
Yeah, you did a presentation not too long ago there.
I've spoken to the school board any number of times, and it is a model of the breadth of the opposition in which we have anti-Common Core activists and Tea Party folk and badass teachers and apolitical moms and teacher union folks all working together with our school board to turn around idiotic state and federal policies. And, I mean, the situation is such that the superintendent in Miami-Dade called it insanity. Under the race to the top, his district, Miami-Dade, is going to have to make 1,200 new tests in order to get the measures that are needed to do them, to evaluate teachers based on their students' test scores. It's, you know, whatever you think about how much standardized testing there should be, this amount is ludicrous.
Well, let's take it a little further. How about in those areas where they want to test preschoolers?
Well, that's another issue. And indeed, under No Child Left Behind, there is testing in kindergarten for Race to the Top. And many states, like Florida, have a system of preschool testing. Sometimes it's how well they can recite gibberish syllables and letters, a test called Dibbles. And in other cases, it's developmentally inappropriate assessments designed by bureaucrats who don't have a clue about how young children learn that is being used to assess them. I mean, indeed, there is a set of people, not just corporate folk, though that they're a part of it, but also ideologues of all stripes. And it's important to understand that the push for testing has been a bipartisan fiasco, pushed both by Ted Kennedy and George Miller, as well as Lamar Alexander and John Boehner, and George Bush and Barack Obama, that they all are pushing for more and more testing, and it seems to never end.
Well, as I have said before, and I know you know probably a lot more than I do, the corporate interest, there's where the money is. Testing, in particular today when testing now will be scored by, or given and scored by computers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's districts have to buy computers, like here in I'm in Los Angeles. Districts have to, for Common Core, they have to spend LA Unified, $1.3 billion they were going to spend to buy iPads for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, then printers, and then rewiring old schools to bring them up to high-speed internet capabilities, the training, and et cetera. And, of course, some people over in London was just salivating. And you know who I'm talking about.
Not about the iPad, but Pearson, which is a big international conglomerate.
No, Apple, of course. I was going to get to Apple, but Pearson first.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are the largest in the world.
And IBM, Microsoft, Bill Gates' company, and some things that are set up in a nonprofit format like the Educational Testing Service and ACT and the American Institutes of Research. Yeah, sure, there is a large business out there that is getting fat on No Child Left Behind and similar things. In fact, Pearson, which was not even a player in this country when No Child Left Behind was passed, was quoted reacting to the passage of the law. Their president at that time said, "No Child Left Behind, that's our business plan." And they went for it as hard as they could. But the law was passed before Pearson started profiteering. So it's, there are multiple forces, not just corporate greed at work here. I mean, it's worth noting for our allies that there is a segment in the civil rights community that has supported high-stakes testing because they are frustrated with the unequal education that has existed in many states and cities and schools, and were sold a bill of goods that, testing and reporting and breaking down scores by race and by income status would help focus resources on improving those communities. I mean, unfortunately, it didn't happen. The United States was making more progress towards the goals of No Child Left Behind, raising overall academic performance and narrowing gaps between racial groups. We made more progress toward those goals in the decade before No Child Left Behind than since its passage. But, there were people who bought in without, the profit incentive because they believed, rightly or wrongly, that it was going to help their kids.
That is one of my most personal and professional gripes, I'm using that word because I don't want to use my real words, with my own
African American community. Mm-hmm. We have bought hook, line, and sinker the BS that has been thrown at us as if it was gospel. And I have said to anyone who will listen to me, one way in which charter schools, this whole reform movement would die is that on a Monday morning at 8 o'clock, every black and Hispanic parent kept their kids out of the charter schools that they're now in. That shows you how much I am angered over the fact that it has been the black and brown communities that have made this whole corporate reform movement what it is today. We were original targets, and they picked us very well. They did their homework. They did the propaganda, and as a result, they were able to get an immediate foothold, and they have never looked back. Mm-hmm. So that's a little
commentary. Yeah, I mean, they did a particularly good job of getting buy-in from the national civil rights groups, you know, with bases in Washington, D.C. There are certainly many individual African American and Latino leaders who didn't buy in. Early on, one of the key leaders, critics of high-stakes testing in Congress, is Congressman Bobby Scott, who's African American from Norfolk, Virginia, and he's likely to be the Democratic leader of the House, U.S. House Education Committee come next year. And, you know, there have been individual Latino leaders who have stood up against that. But you're correct that in terms of getting the support of mainstream civil rights organizations, that has been part of the strategy for high-stakes testing. And the fact that high-stakes testing is advocated by the nation's first African-American president, Barack Obama, helps hold that base of support.
That's a whole other conversation from me.
Yeah, I'm sure it'd be too, but that's not our topic today.
Yes. You know, maybe sometime we'll get together. Remember that famous when he got together in the Rose Garden with the beer thing to quell the thing that happened in Massachusetts? Well, maybe you and I'll get together over beer and have our little conversation about that. Okay. As we move, we got about maybe 5 minutes left here. I want to catch three things from you, and that is, Common Core, how much has it helped the resistance movement?
Well, Fairtest is agnostic about the Common Core standards per se, because the standards aren't something that's within our scope. But we've been very critical from the get-go of the Common Core tests, which both increase the number of tests and their complexity and guarantee that more kids will fail. Politically, the controversies over the Common Core have forged an alliance that I described earlier between folks who are generally viewed on the political right and some on the left in opposition to the testing. Whatever you think of the Common Core standards, you know that the testing is unnecessarily high and high stakes, and that has added to our clout. So, you know, politically, it's helped, and it's thrown a monkey wrench into the American educational system because it's so controversial.
Well, in essence, it too has helped the movement grow.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. So what was billed as the savior for all of public education has turned out to be a Trojan horse for the corporate reformers, and that it opened up the door for more and more people to get on the bandwagon opposing high-stakes testing.
Well, and in terms of testing, the advocates of Common Core overpromised. They said that Common Core tests were going to be a totally new breed. They weren't going to be mindless, you know, multiple-choice, fill-in-the-bubble tests. And largely because of political and time and money constraints, you know, new tests, same as the old tests, only longer and harder.
Next question is, What message is being sent by the resistance to politicians at all levels? You mentioned it earlier, but are we putting out now? Well, we talked about this in an hour before, and that is, I was saying we need to grow our own would-be politicians from teachers, parents, rank to enter primaries. We need to challenge incumbents, both parties, and including the president and the potential future candidate from the Democratic Party. And in order to move this movement, well, to keep it alive, make it successful, and to move it forward. So the question basically I've sort of like answered myself in terms of, are we doing that in terms of the movement?
Yes, I think that the message, there's a message at multiple levels. The most simple level is enough is enough. That, you know, basta, there's too many tests. So a majority of Americans, according to the polling, now agree that it's time to cut the number of standardized tests significantly, end high-stakes uses, and invest in better ways to assess students, teachers, and schools. And it's as simple as that. We need to reverse course from test and punish to teach, assess, and support, and move into a new era that focuses on improving educational quality and equity, not just generating test numbers and corporate profits.
In other words, retaking back the original purpose for education, educating the whole child, educating mm-hmm. the child to be able to become an adult and become a participating person in protecting and perpetuating our democracy. Education that leads to a path for the middle class and et cetera. I'm running out of time, but there's one thing I have to do. You have to give a shout-out to the people at United Opt Out, because our last show 2 weeks ago, both Peggy and Carissa gave Fair Test a major shout-out in mm-hmm. saying and how fantastic you guys are.
And Fair Test works closely with Peggy Robinson and Seresta Smith and everybody else at United Opt Out, just as we do with the Network for Public Education and lots of other groups. Just let me say one more thing. A key isn't just taking back the conversation. It is understanding that testing is no longer an educational issue. It's a political issue, and that to take back control, we have to win politically. And that means persuading policymakers to change their behavior about testing, or replacing those policymakers with people who support better ways to assess. And until we understand that this isn't about educational values, because if it was, we would have won long ago, not about morality and what's best for kids, because we have the high ground on that. It's about building and applying political power to force social change.
Bob, touche, hear, hear, bravo. The whole nine yards. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Dr. Miller. And I hope you and I can do something like this again.
Glad to help anytime.
Okay. With that, I have to say goodbye because I've run over my time. See you in 2 weeks, everyone, and have a good Sunday.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.